You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hillary Carlip grew up in every kid's dreamland, Hollywood. But when Michael Jackson is a classmate and you take dancing lessons with the offspring of Michael Landon and Charlton Heston, you have to figure out ways to get a little attention for yourself. From lighting up her first cigarette as a third grader to bouncing balls off of various parts of her anatomy on the Gong Show to performing singing telegrams to an oh-so-bored Chastity Bono, or Bono. I never remember Bono these days. Hillary seems to have tried it all. Her memoir, Queen of the Oddballs, is published by Harper, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
What did your parents do in Los Angeles?
My parents were very ordinary and ran a business selling juvenile furniture. Mm-hmm. It was so not even close to any of the celebrity, you know, the action in L.A.
So how many of the kids in your class were from normal parents and how many were from celebrities?
Well, they mostly all were. I tended to, as you mentioned, I was suspended. I don't know if you mentioned I was suspended, but in the third grade, I was thrown out of school for smoking on the school playground. But it was in attempts to, I always wanted to be someone different. I felt like an outsider, and I just tried on these different personas. So then I was being Holly-Golightly from Breakfast at Tiffany's.
And your parents sent you into therapy, which was, I guess, the L.A. way even then.
I guess so. But by the same token, a week later, I was picked out of all the kids in my elementary school to appear on TV on Art Linkletter's House Party. So in a way, it was validated from early on that, you know, being an oddball may not be such a bad thing. So I kind of really went for it from then on.
Did you say one of the darndest things?
Apparently I did, yes.
You willing to repeat it?
Yes, I was terrified. Everyone, including my child psychologist at that point, was telling me to just be myself. And I tried to be during the whole questioning from Art Linkletter. But then finally, I snapped into Ellie Mae Clampett, of all people, from the Beverly Hillbillies. And when asked, like, what the favorite thing my mother cooked was, I said in full-on accent, "She cooks up a lot of critters!" And, you know, Ellie Mae was just channeled through, and it got a laugh, what can I say?
Did you have a feeling growing up that you had to be in show business or you were no one?
I definitely had to do something off the beaten path to be someone.
Well, off the beaten path can be many different paths. Your parents, who you describe as liberal and progressive, decided to send you to Cotillion.
They did. Have no idea why. But there, of course, it just further threw me into the feeling that I was no one. I was picked last to dance. I was the big, you know, fat loser. And the piece in the book takes place at the Grand Trophy Ball, where suddenly in these competitions, all of the celebrity children were winning the prizes.
But there were a lot of celebrity children there.
A lot of celebrity
children.
So that
has to be intimidating.
Oh, it was. It was. They were all the beautiful people. But as in the chapter, my father pulled through and started doing these wild kind of bohemian groovy dance steps. And we ended up winning the grand prize at the end and taking home the trophy. So it was a triumph, not just for me and my father, but for all the normal people there.
How did you become friends with Carly Simon?
Well, I grew up in L.A., as you mentioned, and there was a club there called the Troubadour that's still there. That was a very intimate setting, 100 seats. And I saw all the greats there. I saw Elton John do his first U.S. performance there, James Taylor, Carly Simon, Carole King. And I was 14. They didn't have an age limit. And I saw Carly open for Cat Stevens. And I was just so moved by her defiant lyrics and just thought, you know, I have to befriend her. And I set out to befriend her, and it involved, you know, baking a lot of banana bread for her at the time.
Did you think she saw your friendship as a friendship of equals?
I thought so at the time. And then I read an interview in a magazine where she actually mentioned my friend Molly and I, who went every night. She said there are these two girls at the Troubadour every night who just make my day. She went on and on, but then by the end, she called us fans, and I was devastated. So, of course, I had to write her a letter and say, "Fans, I thought we were friends." And God bless her, she wrote back saying, no, of course I think of you as friends. And the great thing about my book is I got to include ephemera throughout the book, and one of the things is the actual letter from Carly Simon where she said that.
Are you still in touch with her, or did that end when you were 15?
Yes, the friendship was short-lived.
And then you went after Carole King, and I say you went after her. You almost stalked her.
You could call it stalking. Back in the day, it wasn't really called that. I was 14 years old, and another friend and I decided to spend our summer vacation on the King case, which involved tracking down Carole King in Laurel Canyon, where all the fabulous musicians lived. And we literally had a notebook with clues and her license plate and maps and addresses of her band members' homes. And we set out to find her, and we did. And she also was lovely. She invited us in. We drank lemonade. And she, in her kitchen, performed Lamaze breathing exercises right in front of us.
Do you think it would have been any different if you had grown up in New York?
Well, you know, I have a friend who grew up in New York who said she kind of led the whole parallel life with, like, she brought a peach to Laura Nero at a concert and gave it to her. I think it might have been just different names and faces.
But I could see some differences. You wrote an essay about Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American presidential candidate who's a woman. And you got a C. That was 1971. I can't imagine that happening here in New York.
This is true. Well, it was actually a photographic essay, and I took pictures of her speaking at a, you know, candidate rally. And, yes, we both lost on that one.
But this also is a sign of your burgeoning political side.
Yes. Well, that started even earlier when I was 9, and my parents had my brother and I boycotting, like, we couldn't buy sugar babies and sugar daddies, anything made by the Welch Candy Company.
Because of the Birch Society connection.
Exactly. So it started very early on. And then when I was 14, I formed a high school women's consciousness raising group. And this might have been part of the L.A. Somehow we got tons of press and notoriety, and the L.A. Times was calling us teen libbers. And we did a lot of great action and had conferences. And
do you think it also was about the time you started to realize that you were finding women sexually attractive?
I think it was. I remember in my women's consciousness raising groups, two of the women or girls, we were, you know, 15 by then, said they had slept together, and it was like, really? I just thought it was very interesting at the time.
My guest is Hilary Carlip, whose memoir, Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from a Life Unaccording to Plan, is available from Harper in a Harper original paperback edition. Your brother Howard is one of the what do we want to say? One of the victims of the era?
Yes, I think he really was. There's a piece in the book about his high speed chase with the police when he was experimenting with hallucinogenic drugs. Very political. He got thrown out of high school for starting an underground newspaper, and the chapter is about his whole experience with that. But yes, definitely of the time.
You mentioned the fact that you were not invited to Carly Simon's wedding to James Taylor.
This is true.
But some of the similar events are mentioned in a single sentence. I can't help wonder, what was Michael Jackson like as a schoolmate?
Well, you mentioned the single sentence. Before each chapter in the book, I have these front pieces. The chapters are chronological. And within the front pieces, I tell what was going on at the time politically, culturally, just music, television, and also personally. So Michael Jackson as a classmate was, you know, it was fascinating. Again, I didn't go to, like, Beverly Hills High, where all the celeb kids went. It was just a normal junior high school, and there was, like, several of the Jackson brothers. So they, you know, certainly got a lot of attention, and he wasn't there for very long before they up and left. But
well, he seemed to have been a very sharp kid. Later, some of the things that we might consider strange developed.
Yes, definitely. But also, the book's a lot about the fringes of celebrity, like that. There was always some being on the fringe.
But you wound up having a certain amount of fringe celebrity of your own. You discovered you had a talent for juggling. How does one discover that?
Well, I was so taken with all these performers and so inspired by them. I knew I wanted to perform. My singing sucked. My dancing was even worse. And I, you know, wanted to, again, always do something different. So a friend of mine knew how to juggle, and I took up juggling.
And you wound up opening for Pharoah Saunders at a club.
I did.
And then you went on the Gong Show.
I didn't just go on the Gong Show. I won the Gong Show. Thank you very much.
And taught some celebrities how to juggle. Lucille Ball, that
I
must have
did.
Been a thrill.
I did. Well, it was indirect, again, on the fringe. I was 15 and teaching juggling out of my home in like a learning annex type of class. And one person signed up, and it turned out to be Bob Carroll Jr., who was Lucy's head writer for I Love Lucy, Here's Lucy, all the shows. And he was learning how to juggle to teach Lucy. So it was indirect.
Was delivering singing telegrams in Hollywood a way of networking?
I thought so. I certainly got a lot of exposure to a lot of celebrities, producers, you know, casting directors. And I did an original act, which included my juggling, which I had, as you mentioned, done on the Gong Show and went on to do in cult films like Xanadu. So for it definitely opened some doors.
But it got you heckled by Ed McMahon.
Ed McMahon had the nerve to heckle me. But the best thing about that, it was at a party for him, and Don Rickles was there, who's usually the biggest heckler of them all. And to see Don Rickles going, Ed, shut up, listen to her, was quite a, it was enjoyable.
Were there high points? Was a singing telegram for Cher a special experience?
Well, actually, Cher hired me. It was for her daughter, Chastity. Mm-hmm.
And Chastity, of course, didn't love it.
Chastity was like tortured. She's like, Mom, what are you doing? Kind of vibe. But everyone else there, it was in their home, and everyone seemed to enjoy it.
Well, after all of being a kind of a groupie to all of these rock stars, you started your own band.
I did.
In hopes of what? Achieving real superstardom?
Well, not exactly, because it was more of a comedy thing. It was I called it an all-girl, all-ex-con band. And the premise was that we had met in prison, and we saw the light in prison, but not through religion, but through TV reruns. And we had a song called Buffy Come Back that actually became a cult hit. And so it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be a rock star, but it did take off in a way I didn't expect. We were the band in the movie Bachelor Party, Tom Hanks' movie, and had songs on other soundtracks. So it really did take off.
Who's Mindy Greenfield, and what's the Rent-A-Fan Club?
Mindy is another persona I created. Rent-A-Fan Club, I started with a partner where we would just be hired to be anyone's fan, like so someone could feel their fame for 15 minutes. And we'd gather personal information about them and be like the president and vice president of their fan club and know everything about them and do oaths of devotion and, you know.
But you'd had training when you were
exactly.
a kid.
Exactly.
What's the show Confidentially Vera?
That was another persona I took on. And it was a character, Vera, was she did the show about the stars who served the stars. And it was like interviewing celebrities like shoemakers and car washers and people who worked with celebrities.
You also tell the story of writing a screenplay for a movie called Skirts. It's so dramatic that you told it in the form of another screenplay.
Yes.
Is this a typical Hollywood story? The reruns, the casting, the green light, and then the whole thing is scrapped?
It happens quite often.
But this thing was really it was down
going.
To the end. It had its cast. There was a crew.
Absolutely.
And then the plug was pulled?
Well, right before it was about to start filming, Columbia Studios was sold to Sony, and they just scrapped all the projects that had been part of Columbia.
So have you stopped buying Sony products as a result?
But also, you mentioned that it's written in a screenplay form. I just want to also add that other pieces in the book are written in all different forms. There's one that the piece about Angel and the Reruns, my band, is like a guide how to become a rock star. The piece about starring in Xanadu was not starring, but appearing, let's say, in Xanadu is in the form of a letter written to Olivia Newton-John. I really mixed it up as divergent as my life has been. Even the way the pieces are written in the book are like that.
Many people in the East Coast think that the West Coast is filled with New Age types, people who dabble in various therapies. And you studied with Marianne Williamson. You say you're drawn to psychics. Is this because you grew up on the West Coast, or is it you, do you think?
Oh, probably, you know, a little bit of both. And the feeling of always kind of searching for the answers.
Were any of them any good?
You know, most of the psychics, which is also included in my book, were kooks. And I'm so not making this up. One had a chihuahua on his lap who was a blind chihuahua wearing a sombrero, not making it up. And the whole time during the reading, he was like, settle down, Pepe, settle down. Like, it was all about the blind chihuahua in the sombrero. So a lot of
kooks. The blind chihuahua actually was the animal who came up with the revelation?
I guess so. I guess
kind
he
of like
was
a crystal
important
ball?
To the reading. Exactly.
Crystal chihuahua.
Exactly.
So now we have the book.
Yes.
But, you know, you're going to have other adventures, aren't you?
Does
that mean more memoir?
I'm still, just a few weeks ago, I was on Ellen teaching her how to eat fire. So the oddballity continues.
And you know how to eat fire while juggling?
Sure. As long as one hand's free. The whole book ends with an appearance on Oprah. And Oprah, let's say she inadvertently really led me to start embracing my oddballness. And the chapter's called Finding the O in Oprah, and it kind of wraps that all up. But still continuing on with oddball adventures.
Do you wish that Ellen had embraced a little more oddballism? She declined when you offered to teach her how to eat fire, didn't
she? Well, you know what? She put it on her tongue. She got that far, but she got too scared at the end to actually extinguish it. But you know what? It made Liza Minnelli run out with a fire extinguisher, and you can't beat that.
And if this weren't radio, of course, I'd be doing it right now. But luckily, it is radio. Hilary Carlip's memoir, Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from a Life Unaccording to Plan, is available from Harper, in Harper Original Paperback. Hilary also has written commentaries for NPR. And as I said, she's a performer and an artist. And I want to thank her so much for being on our show today.
My pleasure.